We've had two acts of the drama, to refer to the dramatists in the audience, and I hope we've wound the plot up, and today is going to be the denouement. It's all going to be solved and everything's going to be all right. Hooray. So I'll briefly recapitulate, and then I'm going to restate the situation in slightly different terms. So if you remember, this is from the Hannibal Sutta. Hannibal, by the way, is probably what we would now call a laddu, for those of you who are aware of Indian food. It's basically wedding food. It's sweets that are often associated with weddings, but not only, little round balls. So this one is made of honey. And so at the end, the Buddha is asked, that was a wonderful sutta, what shall we call it? And the people are saying, well, it's so sweet to the taste. So it's okay, we'll call it the Laddu Sutta. Only he says it in Pali rather than in Hindi. So this sweet sutta, to begin with, tastes a little, not bitter exactly, but real, let's say. So it begins with what I call primary experience, the basic sensation of contact, of the sense organs meeting the sense object in the sense consciousness. So there's a primary sense experience, which then leads to an experience of pleasure or pain or nothing much somewhere in the middle. We don't have an English word that really corresponds to it, so we generally tend to use the Pali or Sanskrit, which is Vedana. And as I warned you, in modern Indian languages, Vedana means simply pain, so we have to re-give it new meaning. So that's the basic data of experience which is given to us. But we're a particular sort of organism. We're a human organism. If we were a fly or a sheep or an amoeba or whatever, we would deal with that basic information in a different way. We would form a pattern, a picture of the world. We'd discriminate the world at a very fundamental, basic level, simply delivered by the forms of our senses, if you see what I mean. It's not intentional, it's not thought about, it just happens. So it's neutral. It's neither good nor bad nor indifferent. It's probably only good or bad in accordance with whether it aids survival or not. So the organism has senses that enable it to gain the information it requires for its own prospering. And at this level, you can't talk about ethics, you can't even talk about right or wrong, ignorant or wise. It's just what happens. The organism does it. Because you've got this sort of nervous system, your sense organs immediately translate experience into certain patterns and forms. That's the basis of samnya. All organic life does that sensing, perceiving. Perceiving is the proper word for it. But what humans do is that they begin to translate that patterning of experience in perception into labels, into a conceived world, a world which is broken up into abstract concepts, which are then applied to the particularities of experience. So we're able to identify our experience from these abstract conceptions. Do you see what I mean? You walk into a room you've never been into before, but you know about floors and ceilings and walls, so you're able to identify what's there. And of course, that becomes extremely sophisticated and subtle. You've never seen this particular green of this particular cushion ever in your life before, but you know green. You carry the concept of green with you, and you've got a rough idea of how to use it. So samnya includes this conceiving, this interpreting of the world through labeling. But it gets more complex. And what begins to happen is that through our conceiving, we develop a sense of I and world. We, as it were, have the conception of self. We abstract from the accumulated experience of a lifetime a single conception of me. Do you see what I mean? So what my experience is now is actually quite a bit different from what it was yesterday. And in a way, I am different. It's a different situation I'm facing. We've been meeting for 3 days, so there's a different sort of dynamic amongst us. I'm not trying to work out whether you're with me or not. I'm just plunging on regardless. I've changed, and it's the same for each and every one of us. Not hugely, but if we're fairly particular about it, actually quite a lot, quite significantly. So that what I do is I apply the abstract label I to all that experience and the memory of that experience. So I've already abstracted myself, my idea of myself, from the continuous flow of experience. And that abstraction of I goes with the abstraction of the world, if you like. And at this point, a whole mass of pre-packaged responses come into play. What are known as the anusaya in Pali, anusaya in Sanskrit, which mean latent tendencies, predispositions, habitual patterns, but very deep, not the sort of psychological patterns that we usually think of as habitual pattern, really deep patterns of ways of handling the experienced moment. These are just sitting there, waiting to come into play, because we've used them again and again and again in our past life, and from a Buddhist point of view, our past lives. We've used these patterns of response again and again. We meet the existential situation, the present moment, which to a greater or lesser extent presents us with a problem. As I've been putting it, it presents us with the problem of pleasure. You might say, well, why is pleasure a problem? Well, it's a problem because it's going to end and because you want it again. So it presents us with the problem in the present moment of how to continue pleasure. With neutral feeling, it presents us with the problem of lack of stimulation. The mind seeks stimulation. It wants to live. It wants to be alive. And so that the neutral sensation, no particular stimulation, presents us with a problem in that regard. We want to find something to engage with. Boredom is probably the strongest experience of that we get. We're just not really, can't really engage. And you want to. It's very difficult to sit with boredom. It's actually quite an important Dhamma practice, sitting with boredom. And then, of course, pain much more obviously presents us with a problem, because pain is pain and you don't like it. You want to get rid of it. So we're presented in the existential situation with this fine capacity for abstracting self and a finely differentiated world. We seek ways of handling it that will relieve us of the problem. And traditionally, at least according to this particular sutta, there are different lists given in different suttas, because of course these are abstractions. They themselves are ways of analysing, which are not, as it were, inherent in reality. They're ways of understanding what happens. So first of all, the first and most basic pattern is, or habitual tendency, is craving. We try to grasp onto, to get hold of or set up for the future, pleasure. And of course, when I say pleasure, I don't just mean immediate, you know, pleasant taste on the tongue or whatever. I mean even very sophisticated issues of a pleasant situation, a whole environment or the person or whatever it is. It's from the most minute and immediate to the most complex and grand, as it were. So we crave, we can't bear the problem that the moment gives us, and we seek its solution through finding things that will give us pleasure, filling up that sense of dissatisfaction and unease. Another tactic that lies to hand, especially where pain is concerned, but not only, not always, inevitably with these sort of analyses, there's a certain crude simplicity to them, which makes it easier to understand, but the more picky-minded will think, yeah, but, so just shut up and accept. I won't do so. Accept that the device, as it were, in order to make it clear, I'm having to slightly oversimplify. So the second tactic is, when there's pain, is to hate, or to be angry, or to reject, to push away, even ultimately to destroy. You seek to deal with the uncomfortable present by finding something that you think the removal of which will resolve the problem for you. So this lies to hand. These patterns, these ways of dealing with experience are sort of bred into us, you might almost say instinctive. The later Buddhism speaks of them as being perfumed into us. I think rather it's stunk into us from our past behaviour, vasana is the word, from our past actions, both in this life and previous lives. We predispose the process of conditioned arising, which is us, to respond in these ways. So it very easily happens. And of course, as I said yesterday, we probably, most of us, fall into preferences, especially for one or other of these. Some of us habitually respond with craving, seek the cake shop, and some of us habitually respond with hatred and think of who's to blame and what we're going to do to them. In the list, the next one that's given is views, and I spoke of this yesterday as the strong inherent tendency to explain. You might almost say to explain away. It's a powerful impulsion to find an explanation for what's going on, because the immediate existential situation is mute. It doesn't tell you anything. It's just giving you sensory data, but it's not. It doesn't come with labels on it like an IKEA catalogue. It's sort of mute. It doesn't have any inherent explanation bound up with it. So we want an explanation. Why? We want an explanation because when we've got an explanation, we think we're in control. We think we've got ourselves superior to the situation, then we can handle it. You can see this when you experience defeat in one way or another, defeat or failure. You desperately want to find an explanation for it, even though the failure continues, but you can say it's their fault. It's because of this. It's this or that or the other. You find a way of explaining, you might even say explaining away, and it strangely gives you a certain sense of success. So it's a tactic, and a very deep and powerful tactic that is very powerfully bred into us, to explain our circumstances. you can see its evolutionary value. If you can explain, then you can find a better tactic for dealing with life. But what I think the Anushayas communicate to us is a compulsive character of this of this quest. We'll see later that, of course, this quest for explanation can be turned to our benefit. But for the time being, we're thinking of it as something that's a little bit blind, a little bit compulsive, and that we've got little control over. You can see it starting to play itself out later on in the sequence. Then you've got doubt, which is this this vagueness about what's going on. It's an inability to clarify what's happening, an inability to come to some conclusion about what to do. It occurs to me, it's the rabbit in the headlights syndrome. It's you don't know what to do, you don't know which way to run. Well, I live in the countryside in Wales, and often there are lots and lots of pheasants on the road. And the pheasants just really do not know what to do. And they run around, and of course, in the end, they make completely the wrong decision. But they clearly have not the equipment to work out the best thing to do. So they choose a kind of indecision and then an impulsive flight right into your windscreen or whatever. So doubt is literally, vichikitsa means two-mindedness. So you're sort of wavering between the two. And again, this is something that some of us are rather prone to. Never been my poison, as I said yesterday. Conceit, this is getting much more fundamental. Essentially, we're all bound up with conceit as it's conceived here. Conceit is the deep sense that you are uniquely important, that I am uniquely important, that the universe is arranged for my benefit, even if it's arranged badly. And even if it's arranged badly, it's arranged badly to get at me, if you see what I mean. And you know, I'm caricaturing, but oddly, one can have that sort of feeling, that it's actually gunning for you somehow. So it's a very deep sense of self-attachment, of self-importance, of the uniqueness of oneself as opposed to anybody else. And of course, it's one way of thinking about the primary difficulty that leads to disharmony, because if you remember, that's what we're trying to ultimately understand. Then, deeper still, attachment to being, which is the strong desire to be in a particular state, to have an identity, is probably the best way of thinking about it, to be somebody somewhere. And I mentioned yesterday, it's when you lose your status in one way or another, when a relationship breaks up, when you lose your job, when you move house, it can be give you a strong feeling of this sort of loss of being. Any rapid, marked change in your life can give you a brief period of desperate desire to solidify again, solidify internally, solidify externally. And again, I mentioned yesterday that in the Tibetan tradition, there's a very sophisticated analysis of what happens after we die and before we're reborn again. Whether or not you can believe in this, it's what is stated. And it's said that at a certain point towards the end of that intermediate experience, there's a desperate desire for a body. Just any body. Give me a body. I just want to be. I want to know who I am. And to be in a certain state. The sort of uncertainty, the complete openness of death is too much to bear. So you want to ground it. So from this point of view, this is in the background of this moment now, is a strong urge to create an identity for ourselves, a compulsion to create an identity for ourselves. And then finally, not to put too fine a point upon it, is ignorance itself, which is the root delusion about what's going on, the failure to understand the nature of the present moment. And, so much one could say about that, but this is enough for now. It's a pretty horrid brew, isn't it, the whole seven. The first view, craving, hatred, views and doubt, are more like the waves on the surface of the ocean. They come and go, and different patterns and different combinations. But as you get to conceit, attachment to being, and ignorance, they're much more foundational. They're there all the time, in everybody, short of a degree of insight. And yes, the others are also ones which sort of form our different characters. So people have different tastes, different tendencies amongst these. So our attempt to conceptualize, to understand the world around us, is tainted from the start by these habitual strategies that we've inherited from our own past life. You could say that we've inherited from our genetic predisposition, our evolutionary predispositions. Our attempt to understand the world around us is already vitiated. And so we're trying to resolve the problem that we've got. And we've got the problem that's created by the existential situation, which is not entirely satisfactory to us, either because the pleasure is not enduring, or the stimulus is not strong, or the pain is, well, pain. So we try to grasp, we try to understand, because through understanding, we can gain some sense of what to do, of how to resolve the problem. So the conceiving passes into thinking. So we use the concepts that we've formed, the ideas that we've got, although those ideas are already tainted, and we try to make patterns out of them that help us to resolve the situation that we find ourselves in. So that we try to analyze what's happening. We try to look at what its causes are, and we try to see what a strategy might be for resolving it. Of course, sometimes it's very straightforward and simple, particularly if the problem that faces us is pretty simple. If something's digging into my back, you know, my jacket's digging into my back, I can just sort of check out what it is and move around and get rid of it. But if especially, it's usually to do with other people, isn't it? If somebody's said something to me earlier in the day or earlier in the week that sticks in, you know, like a thorn that's just gone in, it's got me. I'm desperately trying to explain it. I'm trying to work out why they said that, what they really meant. I'm also trying to explain why they're totally wrong. You know, that sort of mental activity, or am I alone? No, I'm sure I'm not. I remember this so clearly on a very long solitary retreat I did. I keep referring to this, but I was completely alone for 5 months and more or less alone for 8 months. And it's a very interesting experience. And a very powerful experience, because you see your mind absolutely naked. And what I came into it with a few unresolved relationships with people. And I noticed at a certain point that I was having conversations again and again with one particular person. And I'd have these conversations. I'd remember what they'd said. I'd start to think about it and start to think what I would say. Then I would think what they would say back. Then I would think what I would say back. And I get more and more annoyed about what they were saying back. even though they hadn't said anything. And that was, well, I was going to say fascinating. It was actually horrifying. And that was where the thinking starts to get out of control, where we come to this spreading out, this prapancha. What was, you know, in this echoing silence of solitude, with nothing but sheep for company, the mind just races if you can't find a way to ground it. And sometimes these patterns of prapancha, these patterns of out-of-control thinking would go on for days. You know, just having enough awareness to know that this was all a bad play being played out in my mind. That's prapancha. You're trying to see why they did it, for instance, why they said it. You're trying to explain why they're completely wrong. You're trying to explain what's wrong with them that leads them to be so wrong. You're trying to work out what you're going to say to them, and then anticipating, of course, their responses to what you say, and then, of course, thinking of a better way of putting it. This is a rather, not extreme, but not an ideal mental state. And what happens at a certain point in this more personal form of prapancha is that it seems to often come to a kind of policy conclusion. You come to a kind of summary of the whole thing. You add it all up and you say, okay, what it is they are like that, I am like this, they are wrong for this reason, and this is what I'm going to do about it. And when you come to that sort of conclusion, there's a kind of relief. Although sometimes what happens then is the next day it begins to fall apart again. This adding up of your out of control thinking into a summary, which produces a kind of policy, an explanation and a policy, is prapancha samya sankhara. It goes on the microcosmic scale, as I've said, in the individual, in particularly in relation to other individuals. It goes on more culturally and socially, in terms of our attitudes to other groups within our own culture. It goes on in relation to in geopolitics and so on. You get these massive collective attitudes that strangely make people happy in their unhappiness. I will be going to Hungary tomorrow, and in Hungary at the moment there's shades of the 1930s, and the sort of discourse that you're getting reminds you of the early build-up to the fascist era, a lot of stereotyping, a lot of discussion about them. We needn't go into who that is, but it's pretty obvious. It's shared, it's collective, because we've all got similar kinds of painful experience, which is often the experience of the extreme rapid cultural change that's taken place since the end of the communist era. People left without any very clear identity. Hungary is a quite small culture, which is surrounded by other cultures, and you know, like Tesco's is in the small town in the north where I'll be going. I'm making that sound like it's really bad, but you know what I mean? It's sort of an invasion from outside of foreign attitudes and so forth. Everybody goes to it, but they all say the apples are no good. Like we do. So a widely shared prapancha samya sankhara has taken place, which is to deal with the historical, economic, cultural problems that people have been faced with. Okay, that was the problem. Now I've got to solve it for you. Well, you see, you just get rid of it. Well, what you've got to do is work back to primary experience. You've got to come back to what actually is going on, quite literally even, to the basic sensations, to recognizing the pain or the pleasure that you experience. You've got to come back to that try to strip away all the layers that are imposed upon it. I've written them up slightly differently here because then we can get a better idea of peeling back. So we've got the same basic pattern, the basic sensing, which is the immediate sensation and the Vedana. We've got the perceiving, which is the simple organic organization of our experience. You've got the labeling or conceiving or interpreting, which is the more sophisticated, more distinctly human or symbol-making mind's way of handling the world. Then you've got the striving to understand, the thinking, and then you've got the ruminating, associating, out of control attempt to deal with the situation by a combination of emoting and thinking. And then finally, you've got a conclusion, a kind of summary view, which gives you a sense that you've kind of got it, you've understood it. So we want to try to come back to the basic sensing, including maybe the basic perceiving, which we can't ever really get beyond because our organism is arranged to see things in that way, if you see what I mean. We see certain colours, we see certain forms and so forth. We're not bees with eyes on, you know, far spaced and with multiple lenses and so forth. So the world presents itself to us in a particular way, and we break it up in a particular way, quite spontaneously, probably largely preconsciously, and to some extent not because of culture, to some extent because of culture too. But that's still fairly innocent. So we need to try to get back to that and try to deal with our experience from that basis. Because from here on up, you're becoming increasingly removed from direct experience. You're working more and more in abstractions. So we can think of this, first of all, in terms of using our basic tools of Buddhism. Ethics, for instance. If we come to a conclusion that other people are to blame and that they need dealing with, they need punishing or whatever, well then the principle of non-harm should point us backwards, if you see what I mean. If we feel that we've been exploited and therefore we have a right to take back, well, the principle of not taking what is not given comes into operation, and so on. So the precepts restrain us from going too far with our conclusions. Even if we're not able to stop this process from taking place, we can stop it from moving into action. That's what our Buddhist practice should first do. It should restrain us. Sangvara, Panatipatave Rimini Sikapadam, no. But anyway, it's known as a sangvara, a restraint. You use it to hold yourself back from doing things that are harmful. So the precepts are what help us to stop ourselves from getting into action that emerges from the conclusions that our prapancha and out-of-control mind has got to. Samadhi, dhyana, meditation, helps us to deal with the ratiocination and the prapancha. Huh? Because in meditation, you're trying to learn to stay with experience without thinking, or without ratiocinating. You're trying to be fully aware, but without thinking going on. Vitarka vichara. You're trying to just be aware, but without all this going on. You're even trying to get to the point where the labeling and conceiving and interpreting is minimized. So through meditation, you're trying to reel yourself back so that you're much better able to pay attention to basic experience. It's very, very difficult if you haven't trained your mind at all. Well, first of all, by restraining yourself from unskillful action. Because when you're involved in unskillful action, you're just creating more and more disturbance, which is going to come back, you know, through the cycle in renewed disturbance, which is going to require of you more thinking and so forth. So by appeasing, at least to some extent through ethics, you give the new experience more space. So it's less tortured. Through meditation, you try to slow down the process of compulsive thinking. And it can be extremely difficult. And especially if, as most of us are, we're living busy lives in complex situations and feeding our busy and complex minds with more and more media-based distraction. Sorry, chaps, that's the way it is. We actually make it more complicated at the moment. We have to learn a lot of restraint in relation to our new media. I think there's a whole subject of the mind and information technology. A serious, I think it's worthy of a deep investigation amongst us. How do we deal with it so that we use it well, but we don't get, it just doesn't inflame the tendency to prapancha, to distraction and out of control. So through meditation and, of course, living a simpler, more, and if you like, natural life, closer to direct experience. That's one of the problem, I think, with our modern information technology, our technology in general. All technology takes you a little bit away from direct experience. And I think a degree of alienation is implicit in the use of technology if it becomes too much, because you're not really in touch with what's going on. And you can see it, can't you? People sitting just involved with their smartphones and not really aware of what's going on around them at all. Of course, they're aware of what's going on the smartphone, but all of that is abstracted through the technology, which is representing something to you, but it's not reality. It's secondary, tertiary reality, if you see what I mean. Anyway, enough of a rant. I'm as bad as anybody. So we through our attempt to practice meditation, through our attempt to guard our minds outside meditation and to live a more a less distracted and pressured life, difficult, we begin to lessen the intensity of the ruminating, even the thinking, and even to some extent the compulsive element in the labeling, to some extent. But we actually need to think. We need to think. Everything that I've described in thought. And what I've suggested is that through thought, you can begin to work on the bad outcomes of out of control thinking, if you see what I mean. We use thought to get back to what really is. Even though thought is an abstraction from what really is. If we use it in the right way, if we use it in the right direction, it can guide us back to what really is. If we use it in the wrong way, it takes us away from what really is. So we use thinking to give ourselves, so to speak, a direction. A direction to apply ethics, a direction to learn meditation and to control the input into our minds so that our minds are less turbulent and distracted. And we even are able to check our minds. You know, what's going on? Am I distracted? Am I not distracted? We use the mind to give us tools to, sorry, that we use thinking to give us tools to recognize what's going on right now. This is what's called Dhamma Vichaya, the discrimination of mental events, learning to see what's going on in your mind. And it's one of the most basic of Dhamma practices, trying to see what's going on. So you're using labeling, you're labeling what's going on, you're coming to some kind of understanding, but the labels and the understanding are directed back to primary experience, but directed back to the way things really are. So we really need thought. But thought, so to speak, turns round. It turns back. In Buddhist practice, this is often spoken of in terms of yoniso and ayoniso manaskara. Manaskara literally means mind-making. Manas is mind, kara is making. So manaskara means the sort of act of attention, bringing your attention to something. Yoniso is connected with the root word yoni, which is connected with the feminine, female organs, as it were. But what it means is the reality, the basic reality. That's where we come from, if you like. So it's what really is. So your attention can be on the ayoniso, on what isn't really, or it can be on what really is, if you see what I mean. So you can either face in this direction, that's ayoniso, or you can face in this direction, that's yoniso. So you use thinking to try to understand what is really happening in an absolutely basic sense. So you use your thinking to recognize the conditioned nature of the process. If you don't do that, you take it for reality. Here, you take it for reality and you spin off into ever-increasing unreality, secondary, tertiary reality, even worse if you want. You move away from what is into a construction of reality that is not reality, which therefore you cannot find peace and happiness within, because it's out of key with what actually is. So you turn the mind back to, yoniso could be said, the origin, what it means, origin in the sense of where this process starts. With the basic arising of sensations, their hedonic tone, pleasant or painful or neutral, and their interpretation, basic interpretation in terms of simple things like floors and ceilings and so on. And you try to see the conditioned nature of what is arising. You try to recognize it as arising in dependence on previous conditions. So you use, in applying yoniso manasakara or manaskara, you use dhammic patterns to think. You apply them to your experience. You see that what is going on is impermanent. It has no independent reality. You see that it is there's nothing, as it were, behind the experience, either within or outside. It has no substance, and you see that it cannot grant you true happiness because of its impermanent and insubstantial character. It can only give you temporary experiences of pleasure. It can't endure. So you use thinking to reflect upon what is going on in a more minute and momentary way. And if you can do that, you cut off this whole process and you eliminate, ultimately, these anusayas. If you really get deeply into the nature of what's going on, well, then ignorance is removed. You realise there's no state to be in. You cannot have an identity. And you're at peace with that. You realise that there is no permanent metaphysical I to which you can be attached. And you're at peace with that. And so on. So all the anushayas are quieted and they don't arise again as you penetrate more and more deeply into the true character of what is going on. And that's it. It's as simple as that. We apply sila, ethics, to prevent ourselves from acting upon this and being led into disharmony and into conflict, whether internally or externally. We use samadhi meditation and mind training to try to quiet this compulsive associative quest for an explanation that leaves us feeling at some peace. And we apply wisdom, prajna, which is this application of thought to the fundamentals of experience in order to see what's really going on. Of course, that seeing is not in the end a thought, it's a direct experience. As a result of that application of thought, the thought itself becomes unnecessary, if you see what I mean. So you get the experience of reflecting on your immediate experience, thinking that, well, there's nothing substantial here. I can't find in my immediate experience anything that stands separate from the appearances of that experience. And at a certain point, you become completely convinced that this is true because your thinking has reached deeply enough for conviction to arise. And once that conviction arises, thought stops. You simply dwell in the truth itself, with the truth itself. And at this point, this wheel ends and all capacity for violence and conflict is completely eradicated. And it's this that the Buddha was talking about in that sutta. You remember right at the beginning, he's confronted by Dandapani, who asks him, "What do you teach?" And the Buddha says, "I teach in such a way that quarrels and violence and harsh speech do not arise." He doesn't say, "I teach a teaching that doesn't do that." It's the way he teaches that does that. Because the way he teaches points back. It's yoniso manaskara. It points back to the way things really are. And once you've got back to that, then violence and quarrels and so forth can't arise. So I hope that you get some idea of what this remarkable teaching is about. In a way, I've had to go a little bit fast over the last part because it's really important, I think, you're clear about the whole process. And you're probably clearer about the process than you are about how to undo it. At least I hope I've given you some flavour of what's involved, and especially that you've got some idea of this turning back, turning round. And I think this is can be taken almost literally. I remember this is the way I managed in the end to get control of, you know, my dealing with everything I was left with on this long solitary retreat. The way I got control of it was by coming back to feeling. I felt upset when I remembered what had been said. And I tried not to let myself go beyond that feeling, if you see what I mean. I tried to stay with that feeling, and I tried to see deeper down into that feeling what underlay that feeling. And of course, what underlay it was, I felt threatened, I felt attacked, I felt misunderstood. My pride was hurt. My pride was mortified. And I realized that in hanging on to this, long past the occasion in which it happened, he, the wretched person, had probably forgotten completely about it. But it echoed on within me. And it echoed on within me because my sense of myself had been transgressed. And so I looked down inside the feeling of upset, the feeling of pain, the feeling of being hurt. I sort of sensed this strong attachment to my image, if you like, my identity. Put it, you know, quite simply like that. Even in a way, what will other people think? Those sort of thoughts arise in your mind. How I stand in the world. And I was able to look in the solitude of the circumstance and situation. I was able to look deeply enough to realise that actually there was nothing there. That what I'd been upset about, what I'd been defending, what I felt was threatened, actually wasn't there. It was just a sort of mental construction that only lasted as long as I held it. And that if I let it go, it was all right. It was all fine. So yoniso manasikara is to be taken quite literally in this way. It's literally turning back from trying to work out the larger etiology. There is a value in that at times. That's another question. Sometimes we have to think about larger forces and larger circumstances. But we'd have to do that very coolly and with very, very strong maitri, with a desire to benefit, not a desire to get our own back or explain our own pain or whatever, but an attempt to understand so we can help. So we turn back and we look at the actual living processes going on inside us right now, not back then when he said it, but right now, because actually it's not going on right now. I mean, he's not saying it right now. I'm saying it right now, or rather my mind is saying it right now. So you come right back to what's going on right now, which is actually physical. You can even feel it. You can feel where those emotions are, if you like. You can feel the way in which your body is, you know, in my case, it's usually anger, so I can feel the adrenaline flowing and so on. So you come right back down to the underlying emotion, sensation even, and you try to, if you can, get a bit of a glimpse down here at this pre-patterning, which is present in the knot of the underlying situation, if you see what I mean. Present in the knot of that pain is an attachment to my own unique importance, which is actually completely useless and completely vacuous. There's nothing there. So that, I think, is the payload of the sutta. This is what the Buddha is getting at. Try to get back to samnya. Try to get back below the higher orders of samnya, down to the most basic level of it. Use your vitarka, your thinking, to direct you back into the core of the experience, the kernel of the experience and recognize that that kernel of experience is actually constructed. It has no independent existence. And then the whole wheel stops. And this particular wheel of talks also stops at that point. So thank you very much.